Hello, I'm Harry Breedy, and you are listening to a football fans podcast from the people behind CelticUnderground.net. Enjoyed the podcast on Saturday with new guest Henry Vegetable. We tried to do it as raw as possible, so it was while I was sitting going nowhere forever and ever on the way back from Ibrox on Saturday, and he was over the phone, so audio's not going to be perfect, but we don't pretend to be the BBC Sports Sound. I know obviously with the paywall and all the advertising that we get in, the sort of £100,000 a year, you might expect us to have better audio facilities, but all that revenue going in just goes straight in our pockets, so we don't do it. So, apologies for the audio wasn't great, but I hope you get the sentiment of it. Since that game, obviously, it's been really odd. I've been reading one or two of these technical pieces that tell me how well Rangers played and how Peña really marked Rangers out of the game. I do feel there's been a lot of Emperor's New Clothes crap. I'm all for one of talking tactics and modern football, but pretty much I can see with my own eyes that it's particularly from the 65th minute, we played in smoking jackets and slippers, and some of this stuff is crap, and it doesn't matter how you package it up in whatever language you want, Christian, Jack, and whoever, the guy, some of these people are just talking poppycock. Anyway, got another new guest for this week's podcast. If you don't know what that rant was about, go online, go on Twitter, whatever, and you'll find out. And we have a guy from Airdrie who's based in Madrid and writes for a French sports agency, Kieran Canning. So hope you enjoy our next new guest on the podcast. New music playing below just now. You might remember we had the Tuva band on previously on the podcast. This is our new single, Trees. They were pleased with the feedback they got when they were last on the podcast. And then at the end, we've got Mark Sharp with a song specially dedicated to any Rangers fans who decide to listen into this, all two of you. All the good times have gone. So hopefully that is not the theme tune for us in the Champions League coming up. So we, Kieran and I, talking about Celtic against the Rangers game, the strange coverage in some of the media, particularly Sky's odd coverage as well, trying to bum up Rangers as some sort of improved team when it wasn't. And then we preview the Anderlecht game, and I'm going to get Kieran in to talk about the forthcoming Spanish referendum and specifically the impact that might have on football in Barcelona. Anyway, enough of me. This is me, Harry Breedy, with him, Kieran Canning. So I am joined once again by another new podcast guest. They're coming thick and fast. I'm joined by Kieran Canning. Do you want to introduce yourself then to those who don't know who you are?
I'm a journalist based in Madrid, a sports journalist for the AFP news agency. So I have the hardship of covering Real Madrid, Atletico Madrid, and at times Barcelona for a job. So it's hard going, but someone has to do it.
Yeah. So the obvious question, I mean, we'll get on to the who's your first Celtic game, who's your first Celtic hero in a moment. But before that, how does a guy from Airdrie end up working for a French sporting press organisation in Madrid?
Combination of luck and being in the right place at the right time. Luck in languages is probably the best explanation as well. Because I did a bit of Spanish at uni, and then when I did a kind of postgrad in journalism, and when you're starting out, you're trying to get placements in anywhere you can, and but just because I had the Spanish, sort of one thing led to another, and I was able to do a lot of translations and press conferences and stuff that maybe other people back home weren't able to do, and that kind of led to coming out here initially for 6 months. That was nearly 6 years ago. So it's going from strength to strength, and I was out here for about a year before starting working for AFP, because before that I was working for the Press Association, first of all back in Scotland and then out here for a little bit. So that's it. Yeah, basically the old foreign languages can take you a long way.
Do you know, I was just saying that to my wife today. I was talking about how I'm in the car quite a bit and I listen to podcasts and I download audiobooks, and you know, every day's a learning day, so I'm always trying to learn new stuff. But I was actually saying, do you know, I should really be taking that time to maybe learn a foreign language. And since the most commonly spoken language in the world is Spanish, I should probably learn to speak Spanish. So that thought will last for about 30 seconds and then I'll never actually do it. But I really wish I could. So I'm envious of you, so well done. But before we can get you on the Celtic Underground podcast and talk for any longer, we have to establish two things. When was your first Celtic game, and who was your first Celtic hero?
Well, I actually had to think about this earlier on today because I knew, having listened to the pod before, I knew the, at least the first Celtic game question come up. There's a bit of an apocryphal tale from my dad that he took me to a game when I was only about 4 and fell asleep in his arms because he thought it was going to be Paul McStay's last game. And turned out not to be. But the first one I can remember, it was the first game in the 1996-97 season. Right. Up at Aberdeen, 2-2. Miller van Hooijdonk scored a great free kick. And then Aberdeen, I think that was van Hooijdonk scored first, and then Aberdeen went 2-1 up, and Andy Tom scored the last minute winner, last minute equaliser, sorry. And then I remember sort of going to a few more games that season, and then obviously stopping the 10 in a row, and then I got a season ticket the start of the Seville year, so that was a good year to get a season ticket, and I had that pretty much all the way until I moved out here just the start of 2012. So those are my credentials.
Do you know the problem with being in the 12th season of a podcast is that question that you've just answered increasingly is getting closer and closer, I should say the other way around, further and further away. The answer to that from guests is getting further and further away from my first game as I'm getting older, and podcast guests are getting younger. So
why is this chair?
So, do you miss not getting to games?
Yeah, it's interesting because normally I get to a few, so I tend to obviously get the winter break here, so I tend to get back for Christmas, and tend to get to go to a few games around about then, but. For example, not being to a home European game that hasn't been a sort of early qualifier, and I might have been back in the summertime, like a sort of a big Champions League game, for an awful long time. And my most recent experience of seeing something in the Champions League live wasn't a great one, because I was covering the Barcelona game last season. And I'd warned plenty of my family members and friends back home who were on the crest of a wave after the 5-1 Rangers game that the weekend before that, Barcelona had lost at home to Alaves and left Messi and Suarez on the bench. So to expect a backlash, and it's certainly something that worked out that way. But yeah, I think you do miss the big games, the big atmospheres, and quite a few of my friends that are out here have ended up going over or managed to sort them out with tickets either for Rangers games or European games. But it's a kind of, I've noticed it a lot more after the PSG game, that people are almost getting a bit tired of being patronised a bit about, isn't the atmosphere great from foreigners, and then it's all great until the kickoff goes, and especially playing against teams of the caliber of PSG or Barcelona, then unfortunately the gap's getting wider and wider. But no, I mean, I do miss it, but I can't complain. I mean, the number of games I get to go to out here, I mean, really big games and really big atmospheres. So it's different, but you do get some pretty special atmospheres out here as well.
Just you talking on the PSG and what happened there in the Barca game the season before. There's not actually, we talk about ourselves being this huge club, but we're in a crappy league, and the perception of that league is not great. There's not that many clubs across Europe that are of our size, that are similar in terms of their name is well known. You know, our opponents this week coming up, and Anderlecht, a well known name, but they're not quite a 60,000 seat stadium. There's really only ourselves and the likes of Ajax or Feyenoord or something. How are we looked upon in places like Spain? Obviously, on the very few occasions where we actually come onto their radar, I imagine. How are we looked upon as a club?
Yeah, certainly, it does sound kind of a bit patronising, but they are really impressed by the atmosphere, and it's the first thing, Barcelona get, Barcelona seems to get something every year in the Champions League, thankfully it didn't this year, but
yeah.
that's the thing that they're interested in, because it might be a bit different if it was a Sevilla, for example. But when it's a Barcelona or Real Madrid playing teams of that nature, and Ajax have played Barca Madrid quite a lot recently, and you think they're similar size in terms of what you're saying, similar size club, historic club, now in a smaller league, they kind of assume that there'll be easy pickings in terms of the games themselves as a contest. But they are always kind of, I mean, taken aback because of the now sort of, you know, it's so famous, the atmosphere, but it's something to look forward to. And actually, it's more than necessarily, I know a lot of people bring up the quotes from Messi and Xavi and things, but it's actually a lot of times the journalists, you know, it's when they say, you know, plenty of people have said to me that that's either they went to sort of been to Celtic Park and loved the atmosphere, or, you know, that's one of the away grounds that they're desperate to go to, just to experience it. And do I have to say to them that, you know, if they want to go and experience it for one game, then make sure it's a European game or a Ranger game or something, you know, because it's not quite the same when it's Ross County at home or Dundee at home. But yeah, it's a shame that it's that sense of now Celtic are talked about for the fan base more than for the players, or seen as being any sort of real threat to those really top clubs on the pitch.
We always see the Spanish press as being a bit more in depth and analytical on their coverage than our, particularly the tabloid papers. Is there any sympathy or understanding of the increasing gulf between the elite and clubs like Celtic and Ajax in particular? I think of our two clubs because we are huge clubs, but we're in leagues where the consequences of it are that the elite are just moving further away, or is it just, well, that's life and there's no real consideration of it?
Spain's a strange case because there's a constant kind of clash between the interests of the big two, arguably big three now, with Atletico and the other 17 or 18. So there's had to be, you know, there being sympathy. If you're a fan of one of the 18 clubs, then there is, because they can see that they've got that gulf to try and breach on a weekly basis, you know, playing against Barca Madrid. And the gap, even in a big league, when we think about it, we're restricted because of the lack of TV money in Scotland, but even in Spain, there's kind of special financial fair play within the league itself, where the league sort of publishes limits for salary, salaries, transfer fees, amortisation to transfer fees, that every club, you know, isn't allowed to pass. And they published them last week, and you know, Madrid are over 1 billion, and some of the teams towards the bottom are 20 million. You know, so that gap is getting wider, even on a domestic scale. The interesting thing has been how all the pushback and it is a boy you cried wolf by Barca in particular over the Neymar transfer, that even Madrid and Barcelona are now kind of got to the stage where they're accepting some sort of change within the structure of European football, because they've now had one of their prize assets stolen away from them compared to them doing it to everyone else the past 10-15 years, and trying to bring in more strict sort of financial fair play rules at the European level. But it's the same problem. I mean, we've been going around circles for years arguing about some sort of European league, and until that happens, I don't see Celtic's situation changing, because we'd hope that if there was something like that in the offing, even if Celtic weren't in the sort of prime category or the first division or Premier League of it, that there might be some sort of trickle down where there's a tier format or something that the Celtic could get involved in, because I don't see how, other than that, things are going to change.
Well, back to the first set of questions, and who's your first Celtic hero?
I would probably have to be Larsson. First season, started going, he had, I think I would be right about the three Weebos thing, but by the time that I started going much more regularly, Larsson was very much the main man. And even in that team, there were some great players, and Balkan have become legends, and Sutton, Hartson, Petrov, Thompson. Larsson was always a standout, and I think when you see what the when you compare it to that, even now, like that, just sort of 10 years on, how lucky we were, because we were probably just at that last. I know himself could have went earlier, but days for a player like Larsson, we'd be lucky to have two, maximum three good seasons out of him, and he'd be shipped off to the Premier League for 20 odd million or more. So it was great to have him for those 7 years.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it was just on the cusp of, towards the end of his time, he could have been getting 40 grand a week somewhere else, which part of the reason he went. But I think if it had been at the point where, after a couple of seasons, he could have moved on and been getting 100 grand a week, there's no way we would have kept him.
No, and also, like, the transfer fee you'd get from that stage. The thing that also helped us was that he'd had that sort of bad experience at Feyenoord. So I think if he'd come directly from Sweden, there might have been more of a lure for him to sort of move on again, and you know, move up a little, whether it be going to England or going to Spain, looking at it eventually. But because you got to find out things hadn't worked out, and he kind of re-established himself at Celtic and obviously loved it, and you know, felt like the main man, felt like he was improving as a player, that maybe helped Celtic just sort of hold on to him for a bit longer.
So we've established your first Celtic game, and you started going in earnest pretty much from some of the best times as ever been to be a Celtic fan. It's been the period that you've been a Celtic supporter. I was joking with someone the other day that all people who went to watch Celtic between 1989 and 1994 should get priority at the moment for games for at Rangers and stuff like that, to really celebrate it, which gets us on to the Rangers game. So you were working when the game on Saturday, is that right?
Yeah, so I was at the Atlético Sevilla game kicked off at exactly the same time. So there was, I had a bit of one eye on both, for the, at least until the Celtic goal was done, could relax a bit, and then that was ideal because it lasts sort of, half an hour again. So you have to be sort of eyes, well, so say eyes down. You're constantly trying to keep one eye on what's happening on the pitch and the other eye on your computer as you're typing away the report. So but I managed to catch most of it at the time, and then obviously watched most of it back again, just to kind of, I think just as well, just to kind of, because you see such varying reports over what happened, sometimes you want to go back and watch the game and think, you'd actually see that game as I think I saw it, because what they're saying in some of the papers or sometimes on the radio doesn't correspond to what I thought I saw. But it was a strange game in the sense that I don't really see that there was a huge amount of difference from the 5-1 game at Ibrox last season. It was just in terms of Celtic's final ball, the number of times that they got in behind in the first half, and the final ball, the shot, you know, was just a bit wayward. Whereas in the game back in, I think it was April, it was 2-0 inside 10 minutes, and it could easily been the same on Saturday. But even though the goals took a bit longer to come, I don't think there was any doubt over the outcome.
I mean, I was at the back of the Brumon rear on Saturday, so that, you know, in the first half, you're not getting a perfect view of the other end of the park. But in the first 10-15 minutes on Saturday, I just thought Rangers cannot cope with their movement up front. They, you know, and what was the start of red? Rangers had in 90 minutes two corners and one shot on target, and in the first 90 seconds, Celtic had two corners and one shot on target. So, you know, I agree with you that they just couldn't cope. And then once the second goal went in, which was what, 65 minutes, from that point on it was just all Celtic, and you could see the Celtic players were quite comfortable on the ball. Yeah, as you touched on there, and as I discussed with Henrik Vegetable on Saturday when I was getting texts through, I've not seen it, but the Sky coverage seemed to be talking up very much the Rangers had closed the gap with Celtic. Oh.
I've watched a bit back of the Sky coverage on YouTube, and what I can understand, they seem to be talking themselves around the circles, because in the same sentence, Collins and Lovenkrantz were the pundits, and Collins said that Celtic had the same number of shots on goal, same number of shots on target as the 5-1 game, and you know, scored another five, and in the next sentence said, but you know, Rangers did really well, and they've improved a lot from the 5-1 game, and at least sort of dug in a little bit. The other thing I would say, maybe a stretch from about 25 minutes to half time, first of those chances dried up a little bit, and then Rangers obviously had the one where Morelos at the back post, where you couldn't reach the Tavernier cross, but that was only real, and it wasn't even a kind of spell of pressure or dominance or anything. It was just that they were maybe maintaining it a bit, holding things a bit firmer at the back, but it was more you talk about the press, Spanish press alone. I think the biggest difference is more that there's so much more talk about tactics over here, both by the managers after the game, and then the analysis of it. And so you get a lot of talk about different sort of styles and pressing and things. And one of the things that often comes up here is about how that the worst thing you can do is press badly, because either if you stay or stay back, you know, in a low block, don't press in the opposition half, you try and narrow, you know, leave as little space between lines as possible, or you go the opposite way, you press really high, all the lines have to kind of then come up, press behind that, and you tend to have a bit of pace at the back in case the ball goes over the top, to come back. Whereas it's hard to see what Rangers' idea was, because Morelos and then a gap But then the midfield weren't really pressing as a whole. There's a number of times that Celtic in two passes went beyond the whole range of midfield, and either Rogic or Roberts or Armstrong was running at the defence, and there was no kind of it was just kind of disjointed in terms of each man was doing what he wanted to do and what he thought he was supposed to be doing rather than pressing as a team.
Yeah, because I think I mentioned this to Henry Baseball on Saturday. I couldn't quite understand what the point was. It didn't look like he wasn't supposed to be doing it, but Morelos was the only guy trying to press us. So as I say, it didn't look like he wasn't supposed to be pressing, but he had absolutely zero support from anyone else to press. So all you've got is your one guy up front is then using up all of this energy chasing around, and he's never going to successfully close the play down on his own when we're so used to playing out from the back. So no player's going to panic when he turns up. I couldn't get my head around what the point. And then it's interesting you make reference to the Spanish press being so analytical, because that was another thing that I was bemoaning about. I got someone had posted up a clip of the second goal where the ball's played up, and Andy Walker just says it's just cliche ridden nonsense, it adds no value to it. Break of the ball from Lustig, who plays it to Roberts, and Griffiths scores. Well, for a start, it was McGregor who played it to Roberts and Griffiths scores, but it wasn't a break of the ball. The ball was played to him. You know, it was just that led me into a conversation with a couple of friends about the value of pundits, and for me the role of the pundit, surely, and your point about the Spanish press, is to add value, is to give me some additional information that makes me think differently about what I'm seeing on the screen. You know, not to be like a Craig Patterson pundit who the commentator says something like McGregor to Roberts, Roberts through to Griffiths, Griffiths scores. So Craig, how did that go? Well, McGregor played it to Roberts, Robert passed it to Griffiths, and Griffiths scored. You know, surely they've got to be adding value. I mean, that's one of the things that when I can't read Spanish, as we talked about a minute ago, but when you get a Spanish press, there'll be a double page pool that's patently a tactical review or preview of the game and then a tactical review. I mean, is that a big thing amongst the Spanish press that they see that that's part of their role?
It's kind of mixed. So the Spanish press, it kind of falls into several different strands. So quite often there's arguably even more nonsense in the Spanish press, because they've got it's so in terms of newspapers can be so biased in terms of there's two Barcelona based sports dailies, Sport and Mundo Deportivo, and then two Madrid based ones, Marca and AS. So it's very much there's like a Real Madrid slanted angle or a Barcelona slanted angle, whereas a lot of and you do get some good tactical stuff in there, but the lot more you get like broadsheets by Zamundo, like their sports sections, and you quite often get some good tactical pieces in there, or the big media outlet, particularly for football in Spain, is still the radio. And so they have these, I mean, the sort of best paid sports journalists and things will all be radio presenters, and they have these shows that start about 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock at night, every night of the week, and especially after sort of night games, you'll quite often get a big tactical analysis of what's happened. I mean, even for example, the Girona played Barcelona at the weekend, mm-hmm. and the big sort of analysis that's come out of that, and they sort of talking about the big sort of talking point, other than the fact that it was two Catalan teams playing in this week, so there was a lot of demonstrations and protests and stuff about the Catalan independence. But the kind of football angle was that Messi was man marked throughout the whole of the game, and how there was kind of a debate about it, because Girona kind of won the battle but lost the war, because Messi's, for that game, he scored like 12 in 8 games this season, been even by his standards, in incredible form, and they managed to kind of limit him and keep him by his own standards relatively quiet. But obviously if you're going to sacrifice a man just following him wherever he goes, he knew then how to kind of drag him out of position and then create overlaps. So the Barcelona were always getting in behind, whether it be Suarez or runners from midfield. So there's definitely, I mean, I've looked at a lot of the press reaction, and I can't think I've seen much in terms of a tactical analysis other than it's either been Celtic are still streaks ahead because they've got better players, or, you know, Rangers a bit more and kept the score down. There's very little in terms of how did Rangers go about trying to stop Celtic, why did they work, why did it not work, and what did Celtic do to overcome it. The only slight thing I've heard was, I think on the Sports Sound podcast, they were talking about how, you know, obviously now with Rodgers, you know how Celtic are going to play. It comes back, I mean, I completely agree with your complaint a few times in previous pods about games in Celtic Park where people want the ball to be played up the park. You know, mm-hmm. It's like, if you've been watching this team for the past 18 months, you know, that's not what Celtic do. And it's one of the major reasons why they improved so much under Rodgers. Mm-hmm. And what I was saying, the Sports Round program was about how you can't tell what does a Cascina team want to do. I mean, for all that they criticised him, you could tell what Warburton was wanting to do, and that he had a plan. Maybe he wasn't flexible enough, but, you know, there was at least a plan there. Whereas it's hard to tell what is Cascina's style of football philosophy.
Do you know my thoughts on the way pundits are in Scotland were not all, but what I think is wrong with punditry at times in Scotland was summed up when I was in the car on Sunday and the Aberdeen Murrow game was on, and Willie Miller and Gordon Smith are talking, and there being a corner kick, and obviously something had happened at one of the posts, and Gordon Smith said, that's why I would always stick somebody on a post. The amount of goals you see going in that you think, if somebody was on that post, they would have cleared it. And then Willie Miller said something about, yes, but it's just not the in thing to have people on posts anymore. And I think that Liam McLeod, the commentator, said, so why's that? And Gordon Smith said, I don't know why they stick people on the posts, why they don't stick people on the posts, it's just a modern thing. And Willie Miller said, yeah, I don't know why they don't do it either. And I'm thinking, well, your whole reason for being on is actually to explain why. I mean, I don't believe that suddenly, like 10 years ago, some coach said, you know what, I don't think it's trendy that we should stick somebody on a post and nobody do anything about it. You know, there must be a reason why modern coaching has decided not to stick somebody in a post. And whether you agree with it or not, surely the job of the two pundits is for Gordon Smith or Willie Miller to say, well, the reason why we've moved away from guys on posts is because of XYZ. It gives you an extra man when you're zonal marking, or the amount of goals that people realised that were going in because a man in the post played a striker onside and allowed him to stand right on top of the keeper, or any of these types of comments. And then for someone to say, I disagree with that because I think it adds value here, there, but at least explain to the listener and add some value for being there, not to say, I don't know why they do it.
But I think this is a kind of, it's not, I mean, I know we complain about it a lot, it's not purely a Scottish thing. Like, there's a guy that I know that he's done, called Ken Early, who writes for the Irish Times, and he's got a good podcast as well. And he did a good piece today about how, you know, that Liverpool and people hammering up and talking about how Liverpool can't defend. And the point he was making is that they've had, other than Man City, the number of shots against them this season, and it's because the Klopp's whole idea is that you defend far away, and it's very much Guardiola's, where you defend far away from your own goal. And the more time you're pressing, the more time you spend in the opposition half, then the less number of shots you're going to have on your own goal. You'd stick 11 men behind the ball and try, you know, block everything, but the chances are over the, you know, over a large course of games that you're going to concede more goals like that than playing on the front foot and trying to play in the opposition half. I completely agree with you. You're talking about the posting, because it always annoys me as well that they talk about whenever someone can see zonal marking, it's zonal markings that fault. But quite often it'll be an individual will fail within, you know, that zonal marking structure, which is exactly the same if someone loses their man or makes a mistake or just gets beaten for a header on a man marking setup. And if so many coaches are using zonal marking, they're not just doing it because that's, you know, they prefer to zonal mark. There must be reason. Statistically, it must be backed up that zonal marking, or at least in a mixture, in a sort of a mix of part zonal and maybe two man markers, best headers of the ball position team. It's not just a modern fad because people like doing it. It's completely backed up by the stats.
Yeah. So getting back to Sky talking about Rangers being closer to Celtic, why do you think they had a different tone? Because it's not just Radio Scotland who are different. Most of the press that I've subsequently read has talked about there's still a gulf between Celtic Rangers. Why do you think Sky were behaving or talking the way they did?
Yeah, I know the idea you're talking about there, that Sky have, you know, bought the rights to the SPL, and so they have to try and sell the games to as big an audience as possible, and the best way to do that is to try and hype it up and talk about the fact that there's a competition and it's not just one-way traffic for Celtic. But having said that, having watched it back with the analysis, I'm not sure it really constitutes analysis that they had on. I wonder if it was even that well thought out in terms of them trying to play that line of talking up the fact that the Rangers closed the gap, because as I say, quite often they were kind of contradicting themselves from one sentence to another. So I don't know if it was a case of they were really pushing that line that, you know, they need to sell games and pick it up, or it was just the case that the analysis they had on the day wasn't particularly good. Because I think you maybe see that sort of intention a bit more in the way that they sell the game beforehand, and I'll try and big it up in Sky Sports News on the sort of few days before the game and stuff as well. But I don't tend to see a huge amount of the Sky coverage obviously being out here. But I actually had a few Scottish guys out here last week, and they were saying to me, loads of people said to me about the difference in coverage between Sky and BT of Scottish football. It's incredible, and that everyone seemed to think that BT at least seemed to almost to treat them a bit more respect and take it a bit more seriously. They seem to be putting a lot more resources into it than Sky. One of the guys was saying to me last week that apparently there was a Celtic game last year on Sky where it just the transmission just finished as soon as the game finished.
I might have even been, you know, like a relatively important game. I can't think what it was, but I think I may have been at it and so didn't see it. But that was the big criticism, that basically Sky just went, I think at the end of the game they went for an ad break, and everybody watching it just assumed they were going for their ad break, and then they would come back to the post-match interviews and stuff. And then there was an English I think it was one of these ones where there was a Celtic game and then an English Premiership game started almost straight away, and so there's just no time for any coverage of it. Whereas BT at least seemed to actually want to cover the game. I think this season Sky appear to be making an effort. They've got rid of Tanner. They've got they got rid of Neil McCann, they brought in new pundits, they brought in Hayley McQueen or whatever her first name is, and I think they're trying, and I think that's down to the TV contract being up for negotiation, and they don't want BT getting the whole kit and caboodle of the whole of Scottish football just because they don't want a competitor getting a foothold in it.
Interesting, because the whole Sky Mall's kind of fragmented a bit this season, and the whole, you know, splitting things out to the, there's so many different channels now between Sky Sports Football and the main event, and all the different channels of different sports, and it's, you know, some of all I, you know, to do with the sort of problem that could be coming of less and less people willing to pay the subscription fees that people are paying at the moment, and the, you know, the sort of TV contract bubble bursting, and you, these things, you know, tend to, the states tend to lead the way, and you know, there's been huge drop offs in a lot of the US sports, and the ESPN laid off a huge number of people, I think it was earlier this year, so it'll be interesting, because I mean, Sky definitely overpaid for the Premier League rights, and that they're back up for negotiations later this year as well. So it'll be interesting to see what happens then.
Well, anyway, that's enough talking about this sort of media stuff. We convincingly beat Rangers on, I think you're in the same position as me, we convincingly beat Rangers on Saturday, and there's still a massive gulf between the teams, and really we are now, our main challenge is moving, is European football. So we've got the Anderlecht game coming up on Wednesday night, so how do you see that going?
It's very hard to tell. Cousins keep laying at me from my negativity, because this Celtic WhatsApp group, and whenever they're high as a kite going into a European game, I'm always sort of a bit more cautious, because no matter what we do in Scotland, it doesn't particularly mean anything going into uni. It's so hard to judge any performance that we put in Scotland in terms of, will it then transfer up until and then add it in, you know, you know what you're going to get from a PSG, you know what you're going to get from a Bayern, you really don't know what level this Anderlecht team is at, because it did very well in Europe last year, got to Europa League quarterfinals, but obviously a lot of, you know, first of all, lost quite a few decent players, and a starting manager, so it's hard to tell. I mean, I was relatively impressed with what they did in Munich, given the circumstances of they went down to 10 men after 10 minutes or so, and they had one really good chance to equalise it about 5-10 minutes into the second half, so I mean, they probably would have still gone on to lose, but they certainly didn't capitulate, and I would be very happy with a draw on Wednesday. I know a lot of people looking for the win, but I think given that we're kind of, to say hope that it becomes just a kind of a Europa League playoff in the away and home games against Anderlecht, having that home game as the last game, if we went into that, you know, knowing that a win would get third place, then I'd be relatively happy. Another thing to bear in mind is actually because it's the head to head for third place, rather than head to head with both teams level ends level on, and I don't want to be too negative here, but it could be important to lose by one goal and not two or three. Do you know what I mean? Like, even it won't seem like it on Wednesday night, but given that it's on, it could end up being almost like a two-legged tie. You know, quite often if you're playing the two-legged tie in Europe and you lost the first leg 2-1 away from home, you wouldn't think it's a a terrible result. So obviously aiming high on that, but I think I'd be pretty happy with a draw.
No, I get your point, and I mean, there's sort of two ways that I'm looking at this game. One is, if you look at last season, we went to, I was going to say Main Road, it should show my age, went to whatever Man City's ground's called these days, we went to Man City's ground and we got a draw. We away in Germany, we got a draw. But at home against Mönchengladbach, obviously was the defeat, there was the heavy defeat in Barcelona, there's been the heavy defeat against PSG. How would you set Celtic up? How would you approach this game?
See, I think, I mean, but more than the PSG or Barca or even City games last season, I think the qualifiers should be a better measuring stick for this game. Because I would say that, you know, the level of Rosenborg or Nastat is closer to Anderlecht, obviously, than Anderlecht or to PSG. My only real doubt about the team for Wednesday, presuming Boyata's good to go again. I mean, I know it's kind of, it's a lot of games in a short period of time coming off his injury, is whether he'll go from the team that started on Saturday, if maybe Incham comes in for a Rogic or an Armstrong. I think Anderlecht will probably be slightly better than this, but the template kind of has to be the Rosenborg away game, because I think that in terms of even almost all the time, apart from maybe some of the Neil games and qualifiers early on, there was one year in particular where qualified for the Champions League very easily. That was about as good or composed, at least in a way performance from a Celtic team that Rosenborg game, in terms of not panicking because the old goal didn't come early on, but dominating possession, and then once like Griffiths came on, then starting to create chances as well. So although it might seem a bit attacking if you go with more or less the same team as Saturday, I think that's where Celtic's strengths lie at the moment. So you better put your best foot forward, and I'd say going with that team again, maybe with Incham in for Armstrong or Roglic, just maybe add a wee bit more more physique and balance in the midfield. But I think other than that, you know, I can't see Dembele. Is obviously only played 10 minutes the weekend, so Griffiths will start. Hopefully Dembele can come on and have a good 20 minutes or so in him. I feel a bit for Forrest, but I think Roberts was signed for games like this, so he'll start. Sinclair, obviously, Brown, and Tierney, someone which Boyata will still be gone.
So, yeah, I think I'm with you. I mean, maybe the difference is I might I might also not start with Rogic, but pretty much I think this sort of level, as you say, Rosenborg away, we've shown that we can compete and perform against teams at that sort of level. And I know obviously we're just about to play Anderlecht. The only thing that we have found with Barcelona last season, PSG this season, Barcelona last season, we tried the playing on the back foot and being defensive, and they thumped us. And we tried to be a bit more of our own game against PSG at home, and they thumped us. How do you think? Obviously, I'm not talking about going from losing six goals in the Nou Camp to winning in the Nou Camp. But how do you think we move from losing 5-0 at PSG and 6-0 at Barca? How do we move to bridge that to we lose by a goal, we get a draw at home? Is there anything that you think we can do with the team and the setup to close that gap, or is it just we just have to accept that we're going to get thumped every so often?
Unfortunately, I think it's the latter, because I was saying this to someone before the game last season and after PSG this season, that having covered, God, it must be new, going to hundreds of games either at the Bernabeu or Camp Nou now, and particularly those Champions League group games where they know that they're going to get through the group, they're going to win the game. It very much depends on the attitude of the Barcelona or the Real Madrid or the PSG. So you might get lucky and they might have a big weekend game coming up and they ease off a bit and, you know, would settle for a 1-0, 2-0. Unfortunately, I think an example of that was maybe the Barcelona home game last season.
Uh-huh.
Where Celtic, right, it was 2-0, both sides were almost relatively happy because Celtic didn't get hammered, Barcelona got their win. Whereas for Celtic being unfortunate is the Barcelona game last year, as I say, came after losing home at Alaves, which was a massive shock, and because it had been an international break just before it, that's why Barcelona rested a whole load of players against Alaves, because they'd just come back from international duty, they get beat, so they need to respond, plus those guys have just been rested and therefore are raring to go. And the PSG game is the first champion, you know, Neymar and Mbappe have been brought in to win the Champions League. Winning Ligue 1 isn't going to be enough, so it's their first game together in the Champions League. You know they're going to want to put on a show. So from that point of view, when we got PSG and Barca at their own times, it'll be interesting to see what we can do against Bayern, because I don't think Bayern are as strong. I mean, they're still an incredibly strong team and still should be too strong for Celtic, but I don't think they're quite maybe at the same level as they've been the past few years, and there's two problems with Ancelotti. So maybe it's a tough ask getting anything from Munich, but I don't know, maybe in terms of, if we're looking for a game in which the Celtic can get a shock in this group, I think maybe the home game against Bayern would be the one to target in that sense. But my fear would be maybe that the way the fixtures have panned out might not be great for Celtic, in that if, you know, Bayern are going to PSG this week, expect PSG to win, which would mean Bayern would pretty much need to win the games against Celtic, and then if they do that, then unfortunately they might be through by the time they play Anderlecht in Brussels, so that type of thing might work against us. But I suppose if you concentrate on your own games, and especially two against Anderlecht, if Celtic can get 4 points from them, then I think you should be able to get Europa League. And it's like, I mean, everyone's been saying it from before the draw was made, that if you offered us getting into the Champions League, especially in a group like this where you've got that kind of mixture of prestige and big games, and hopefully get the finance of it, but also got Europa League football and got, you know, something after Christmas, and into a competition where you can compete and sort of dream of going far, then I think everyone would settle for that.
Yes, it's interesting some of the stuff you're saying there about Bayern Munich, because after we get beat by PSG, I was saying to someone, look, our next four games are Ross County, then it's Dundee in the League Cup, Rangers in the League, and Anderlecht in the Champions League. If we win those next four games, we are well on route towards back-to-back trebles, and we would be favourites for European football after Christmas. And so we've won the first three of those four games, and I know I'm not certainly not being blasé and, oh yeah, we're going to go to Belgium and win on Wednesday night, but certainly I think we're capable of getting a result, we're capable of winning, and we're capable of drawing.
I think I'd say they're. I mean, I know we're probably all fearing a wee bit. I mean, they haven't actually named a new manager yet, so still, as far as I know, it's still a caretaker. And we're all a bit fearful of a kind of new manager bounce. But I mean, you don't sack the manager if things are going great. So, I mean, they're obviously not in great shape. So, no, definitely capable of winning. And it's just, I mean, it's kind of, especially in it's another thing I always get brought up here, that they always talk about these games designed by the details, so it's, you know, the small margins. And even if you look at, like, our results last year in the Champions League, in many ways, I think in the two Mönchengladbach games, there wasn't, you know, a huge, it was basically Toure had the kind of two errors at home, but that game could easily have gone out at, you know, played out at 0-0.
Just very quickly to pick you up on that, I always make the point, I was actually on holiday in Disneyland, Paris, and I missed the first half of that game, and so I only saw the second half, where ironically it was the second half that they scored their goals in. But because I missed the first half, where by all accounts they were by far the better team, their two goals in the half that I watched came completely against the run of play, because we were doing alright, we were matching them across the park.
And then I would say the away game was a bit the reverse, in terms of really were under the caution, 1-0 down, but then get the penalty and send it off, and could easily end up winning it. If McGregor scores that chance at the end, then we'd probably finish third in that group. So it comes, especially, I don't think either side on Wednesday is going to run away with it. I mean, it's going to be pretty close. So it's just, I mean, it's the simple things of taking your chances. I mean, I think that's maybe the only worrying thing from Saturday, is going to have to be an awful lot more clinical. I mean, it's fine doing it against Rangers, because, you know, even at halftime, you're thinking the goal's going to come. Whereas when you get those chances, especially away in the Champions League, got to take them. And certainly, obviously, defend a lot better than against Astana away or PSG at home. But I'm hoping that now we've got two fit centre backs, things might settle down a little bit in the back as well.
Well, you're hopeful, because I often think sometimes it a player not playing well, or a section of the team not playing well, then has an impact on the other bit. So if you're Scott Brown and you know your two centre halves behind you are not firing all cylinders, and one of them's a midfield colleague playing at the centre half, you're going to play slightly differently, because you're permanently thinking about your two guys behind you, and so that means the midfield doesn't function properly, and so on and so on. It goes through the team. So I'm hopeful that with Lustig, Boyata, Simonovic and Tierney playing a defensive four guys who are our first four choice defenders, that helps give confidence to the team that the midfield functions better, and so on and so on, and so we don't get a repeat of the Astana game. And there is a small part of me thinking, we win or draw in Belgium, particularly if we were to win, and could get at least a point out of one of the two Bayern games, that actually we could get to the point where we've, the opposite of what you just said about Bayern then play Anderlecht when Bayern are already through and Anderlecht get a chance, you could actually have the opposite of, by the time we get round to playing Anderlecht, they're sitting on 0 points in bottom of the group, and we're sitting on four, and actually we're already secured third place. I know it's a big leap, but I don't think it's beyond the realms of possibility that we could do that if we can get it right.
Yeah, and I think especially if Bayern were to get something at PSG tomorrow night, then that, or Wednesday, that could help us as well. Certainly, I mean, certainly want Bayern to be be playing for something in that fifth game, so they can't feel up the pedal. I mean, I would imagine, given that they play each other in the last game as well, because we play Underlay, they'll probably be fighting for top of the group anyway. That may go down to the last game between those two. But yeah, certainly, I mean, I certainly don't see Bayern being as strong as PSG this season. Coming back to what I said earlier about the fact that PSG were super motivated for that, you know, playing that first game in the Champions League after all the signings they've made. I would hope that you wouldn't get another repeat of that at Celtic Park, at least. Playing in Germany is a different story, but yeah, I mean, looking to Wednesday night, I think we've got to approach it as almost like a two-legged tie and see anything that we get from Bayern as a bonus.
So I do want to talk to you about the current political situation in Spain, politics and football, and the possibility of all the what ifs if Catalonia was to go independent. But we've already done this podcast for an hour, so if you don't mind, I'll have you on again and we'll talk specifically about all of that and the implications for Barca and Spanish football on that. So we'll talk about that another day. So let's get back to the Anderlecht game. What's your prediction for the score for the Anderlecht game?
I'll be positive and I'll say 2-1 Celtic.
You just said you missed a negative on the WhatsApp group, so your cousins are going to be falling off their chairs listening to that.
They've probably got us down to 4-0, so I'm being negative. I'm only going for 2-1.
So who are the Celtic goal scorers?
I think Sinclair's been good in the European games, but probably PSG apart, but I think you give everyone a pass for that one. So they've Sinclair and Griffiths, like, hopefully getting his goal. I know his goal scoring form has wavered a bit before the weekend, but hopefully that'll settle him down. So yeah, Sinclair and Griffiths.
Excellent. Well, I'll settle for that. And with that, I'll say Kieran Cannon, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me on. Cheers.
Enjoyed that podcast with Kieran. As I said, we're going to get him back on because there's some really interesting off podcast chat about the implication of this referendum in Spain, the fact that it's not a legally binding referendum, so how things will behave thereafter, and how Barca are maybe not quite as openly pro-Catalan as some of us over here think. Anyway, enough of me. Don't forget, if you liked the basketball podcast that we did, they've got their first game coming up on Sunday, after the Hibs game on Saturday. Hopefully we get the result against the Anderlecht, and I will say, this is me, Harry Brady, saying goodnight and God bless.